Yes, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Collaboratory Conference Call. At this time, all participants are on a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the conference, please press star and zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, this conference call is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host, Ms. Terry Jalon. Ms. Jalon, you may begin.
As all or most of you know, this is going to be one of the 100,000 Lives campaign next interventions that they'll be focusing on. So it's really timely that we're going to start talking about this. And we have a great panel on the call with us today. We did send you some materials. We sent you three presentations before this call. The first is John Carson. He is from St. Peter's Hospital. So we sent his presentation to you on Monday. We also sent one, Dr. Brian Cole, who you all know from Beth Israel Medical Center, the Director of Infection Control there. So he'll be giving a presentation a little bit later on. And finally today, we sent you a presentation that Dr. Bruce Farber and Donna Armolino put together from North Shore University Hospital. So and then at the end of the call, we'll just go through some kind of housekeeping details after a Q&A session. I should make note, we did extend this call a little bit to 3:45 just in case there are a lot of Q&A and discussion, because we know that there has been a lot of interest in this topic. So without further ado, I'll start by introducing John Carson. John is from St. Peter's Hospital in Albany, New York. He's an antimicrobial management pharmacist. I hope I got that right. He's going to start off the call by talking about the changing nature of C. diff. Once John finishes, Dr. Cole is really going to talk about hospital-specific efforts in reducing C. diff at one hospital, that's Beth Israel in the Greater New York region. And then we'll have Donna and Dr. Farber from North Shore University Hospital talk a bit about what they've done at North Shore University Hospital, and then also explain a draft C. difficile bundle that they've developed, which should be of interest to all of us. So without further ado, John Carson, whenever you're ready.
Okay, thanks, Hillary. Thank you for asking me to take part in this teleconference. My goals are really threefold. I'm going to describe some of the data that emerged from a CDAD outbreak that occurred in Quebec over the last several years. I'm going to describe the characteristics of the predominant strain of C. difficile that was found in the Quebec outbreak and why it may be hypervirulent. And I'm also going to review some of the contemporary studies looking at the treatment of CDAD. An outbreak of CDAD starting around 2000 occurred, and in fact it continues, albeit at a somewhat lower level, in the Montreal-Southern Quebec region of Canada. This outbreak was associated with a previously rare strain of C. difficile, and the outbreak was also associated with an estimated increased mortality, an estimated 1,000 to 3,000 excess deaths in the province during the two-year period of 2003 and 2004. Now, I'm going to get back to the Quebec outbreak in a moment, but first I want to describe this previously rare strain of C. difficile, which seemed to wreak such havoc up in Quebec. The Quebec outbreak is the largest and most documented outbreak caused by this previously rare strain of C. diff. The strain has been designated as BINAP1, or in some other publications you'll see it as ribotype 027, toxinotype 3. I'm going to refer to it as BINAP1 during this presentation. Now, outbreaks, whereas Quebec was the biggest and most well-documented outbreaks, outbreaks have also occurred in the United States and in the United Kingdom. This strain was first identified in 1984, so it's not a new strain. However, of 6,000 C. difficile isolates typed prior to 2001, the BINAP1 strain was found in 14, or about a quarter of a percent, In the Quebec outbreak, it accounted for 84% of all the type isolates. Now, what makes this strain potentially hypervirulent? Well, it has a number of characteristics which could be linked to that. First, as I'm sure most of you know, C. difficile is a toxin-mediated disease. The C. difficile organism produces two toxins, A and B, and both contribute to the pathogenicity of the organism. The BINAP1 strain produces approximately 16-fold more toxin A and 23-fold more toxin B than the traditional strains. It also produces a novel binary toxin. The role of the binary toxin in the pathogenicity of the organism has not been completely worked out. The binary toxin is cytotoxic in cell culture, and it is also quite similar to a binary toxin produced by Clostridium perfringens. This toxin is called the iototoxin, and that in Clostridium perfringens, it's known that the iototoxin is associated with virulence. The BINAP1 strain also produces more spores, making it perhaps increasing its transmittability. It's uniformly resistant to fluoroquinolones. I'm going to get back to that in a moment. And as I said when I started this, these characteristics seem to make this organism well-suited for increased morbidity, mortality, and increased transmission. Now, my next slide is a schematic of the pathogenicity locus of C. difficile. The TCDB gene is the toxin, the gene for toxin B. The TCDA gene is the gene for toxin A. Over on the left-hand side, there's a TCDD gene, which is a positive regulator for the production of toxin A and toxin B. And in about the middle of the schematic, there's a TCDC gene. This gene is actually a negative regulator for toxin production. In other words, activation of this gene ends up reducing the production of toxin A and toxin B. This is an 18 base pair gene, and in the BINAP1 strain, this gene has either been partially or completely deleted. So you're losing that negative regulator for toxin production. You also see in this cartoon over on the right-hand side are the genes for the binary toxins, which are also not present in the traditional, so to speak, C. difficile strains. Now, the next slide is just a graph of toxin A production from the BINAP1 strain and also from a control strain of C. difficile. And you can see the BINAP1 strain, you have more rapid toxin production. Toxin production starts during the logarithmic growth phase, and certainly the absolute amount of toxin that you end up with after 72 hours is much higher than you see in the control strain. I could show you a similar graph for toxin B production. I'm not going to do that, but the graphs are actually quite similar. Another unique characteristic of this strain is that it's uniformly resistant to fluoroquinolones. In the Quebec outbreak, all of the BINAP1 strains were resistant to all the fluoroquinolones that it was tested again. The traditional C. diff strains usually resistant to about 50% were resistant to fluoroquinolones. In this particular strain, it's 100%. Now, of interest, and I'm going to get back to this in a moment, all the tested BINAP1 strains in the Quebec outbreak were susceptible to clindamycin. That's not a mistake. They were susceptible to clindamycin, metronidazole, and vancomycin. Certainly the susceptibility to clindamycin was somewhat unusual also. Okay, now let's take a closer look at the Quebec outbreak. In 2004, a prospective study of 12, a prospective study was conducted in 12 Quebec hospitals. The results of this study were published in the New England Journal of Medicine in December of 2005, so a year ago. What they found was that a CDAD incidence of 22.5 per 1,000 admissions. This compared to 5.8 per 1,000 admissions in 1997, which was the closest year that they had any any similar data for. The attributable mortality was 6.9%, or almost 7%. Now, in 1997, that was 1.5%. So that's almost that's about a 4.5-fold increase. They felt that CDAD contributed to mortality in an additional 7.5%. There was also an increase in the need for ICU admission and colectomy. Both the incidence and mortality were strongly associated with patient age. And I show that on my next slide. This slide just shows patient age and decades. The cases of CDAD that occurred per 1,000 admissions and the attributable 30-day mortality, the percent attributable mortality. You can see that for each decade, the number of cases and the attributable mortality both increase. I think to put this in a little more real-life perspective, if you look at patients over 60, there were almost 25 cases per 1,000 admissions. That's about one case for every 40 admissions. And one out of 20 of those cases ended up being attributable mortality. If you look at patients over 80, there were actually about 55 cases per 1,000 admissions. In other words, about one out of every 20 patients over 80 years of age admitted during this time frame contracted C. diff. And about 10% of those patients died from C. diff. Now, that works out to about one out of every 200 patients admitted during this period who are over 80 years of age dying of C. difficile. At the University Hospital in Sherbrooke, Quebec, which is about 40 or 50 miles east of Montreal, they did some analysis looking for risk factors for complicated C. diff in their C. diff cases. They define complicated CDAD as the presence of a megacolon, the need for a colectomy, intestinal perforation, shock requiring vasopressors, or death within 30 days. You can see on the slides the odds ratios for complicated C. diff with the different characteristics. As age, clearly, as I was shown in the previous slide, is a risk factor for complicated C. diff. They found that tube feedings in the preceding 2 months, immunosuppression, a peak leukocyte count of 20,000 or greater was associated with almost a five-fold increase in the risk of complicated C. diff, and a peak creatinine of serum creatinine of 2.3 or greater was associated with about a three-fold increased risk of C. diff. They then combined some of these risk factors, and what they found was that if the patient had neither a white count of above 20,000 or creatinine above 2.3, their risk of complicated C. diff was about 10%. If they had either a white count above 20,000 or a creatinine above 2.3, the risk of complicated C. diff was about 28%. If they had both, their risk for complicated C. diff was about 60%. So these are good markers, I think, that we can use to identify our patients who are at risk for a complicated course. And, of course, when you look at these, you would also want to take into account the patient's age. As the patients get older, the higher the risk for a complicated course. Okay, now to get away from Quebec for a bit, the BINAP1 strain has been isolated in the United States. This table I have in my next slide is from a publication which was in the New England Journal of Medicine, once again in December of 2005. It describes C. diff outbreaks in 8 separate institutions and the percentage of the strains which were identified to be the BINAP1 strain. Now, I'm not going to go through this whole slide line by line. What I do want you to notice, though, is the geographical diversity we're seeing here. And we have outbreaks in Maine, in Georgia, in Illinois, in Pennsylvania, and in Oregon, so essentially all throughout the country. This strain has also been identified in the United Kingdom. Now, is all the increase in the incidence of C. difficile that we're seeing, and I haven't really presented data on that, but I think some of the other speakers will, is all the increase due to this new strain? That, probably not. We have an aging population. We have an increase in the nursing home population. We have an increase in immunocompromised population. We've always had trouble with infection control measures. In the Quebec outbreak in particular, some of the hospitals in Quebec, or apparently most of the hospitals in Quebec, have rather antiquated, by U.S. standards, facilities. There's multiple patients in a room. There might be one sink for every four beds. It's very hard, apparently, to set up effective infection control measures in those hospitals. Okay, so in the Quebec outbreak, which antibiotics were most strongly associated with the risk for C. diff? As it turns out, it was the fluoroquinolones with an adjusted odds ratio of almost 4. The cephalosporins, particularly the second and third generation cephalosporins, were right behind the fluoroquinolones with an odds ratio of 3.8. Now, when you look at the apparent increased risk with the fluoroquinolones and the high usage of the fluoroquinolones, you can see that this epidemic in Quebec was likely fueled, at least in part, by the high use of patients on fluoroquinolones. In fact, in one hospital, 36% of all CDAD cases were attributed to fluoroquinolone use, more than one out of three of the cases. And in that period, 23% of all admitted patients to that hospital received the fluoroquinolone. So almost one out of four patients admitted to that hospital received the fluoroquinolone at some point. Now, duration of antimicrobial exposure was also shown to increase the risk. However, there were multiple cases which occurred after just one dose, and we've probably all seen that in our own practices. Of great interest, in the Quebec outbreak, clindamycin was not associated with an increased risk of C. diff. I think we all, when we think of C. diff, we think of clindamycin, and certainly in multiple studies, clindamycin has popped up as an antibiotic that's prone to producing C. diff. What's curious about the Quebec outbreak is the C. diff strains in Quebec were susceptible to clindamycin. Now, I'm not saying that they could have used clindamycin to treat C. diff, but perhaps the use of clindamycin in Quebec did not upset the intestinal flora, or the effect of clindamycin on the intestinal flora also affected C. diff because the particular organism was susceptible to C. diff. So perhaps the propensity of different antibiotics to cause C. diff is really a resistant issue, that broad-spectrum antibiotics without any activity against C. diff may be particularly prone to causing the disease. And perhaps that's why in Quebec we saw with the strain that was resistant to the fluoroquinolones that we saw such a linkage to fluoroquinolone use because they're such high-use agents. So I think to just sum up antimicrobial use and CDAD, for years there's been a general consensus that the antimicrobials most likely to be associated with the disease are clindamycin, cephalosporins, particularly third-generation cephalosporins, and perhaps ampicillin and amoxicillin. Now, I don't think we should delete any from that list, but I think we need to add fluoroquinolones as a class to that list. I'm not really convinced in my reading of the data that any fluoroquinolone is more or less likely to produce C. diff than another fluoroquinolone. Okay, the last topic I want to speak about is how do we treat C. diff? Which antibiotic do we use to treat C. diff? Now, since the early 1990s, metronidazole has been promoted as the drug of choice for most cases of C. difficile. That's based on two randomized controlled trials that were done. One was done in 1983 and one was done in 1996. There have been no trials since then. Both of those trials did show comparative efficacy for metronidazole as compared to P.O.-vancomycin. Now, to move up to more contemporary studies, in 2005, the results of a prospective observational study from the VA Center in Houston and a retrospective study from Quebec were published. Now, both examined outcomes of patients who were treated for CDAD. Now, both showed a marked increase in metronidazole failures and relapses when compared to historical data. Unfortunately, neither of these studies provided adequate data to evaluate vancomycin efficacy. My next slide just gives a table looking at the four studies. The studies on the top are the two historical studies, and the studies on the bottom are the two contemporary studies. You can see in the contemporary studies, the initial response to metronidazole is certainly lower than was seen in the historical studies, and the relapse rate is much higher with metronidazole than was seen in the contemporary studies. And that is certainly what we're seeing here at St. Peter's Hospital. We're seeing more and more patients come back with multiple relapses. Now, unfortunately, the data, we don't really know if treating with vancomycin would be any different. The data just is not out there. In Pepin's study, which was the Quebec study down on the bottom of the table, you can see that a small number of patients were treated with vancomycin initially, and their relapse rate was 39%, which is a little bit less than the 47% seen with the metronidazole, but it's certainly nothing to write home about. Now, retrospective data from Quebec identified risks for complicated CDAD. I actually went through most of these risk factors earlier in my presentation. The one I did not include earlier was that an adjusted odds ratio, there's an adjusted odds ratio of 0.2 for complicated CDAD was observed in patients who received oral vancomycin as initial therapy in this particular hospital. So your chances in this hospital during this study, your chances of progressing to complicated C. diff were about fivefold lower if you received oral vancomycin as initial therapy. I have to warn you that these patients were not randomized, and this is one single hospital in Quebec. So I don't know if we can read too much into it, but it certainly is suggested. Whenever we start seeing increased failure rates with an antimicrobial, the first thing we think about is resistance. That does not seem to be the case here. Neither metronidazole nor vancomycin resistance was observed in any of the BINAT1 C. diff isolates cultured during the Quebec outbreak. In the VA study from Houston, 18 C. diff isolates were tested for susceptibility. All were fully susceptible to metronidazole. And all the isolates tested in the United States BINAP1 outbreaks have also been susceptible to metronidazole. So it does not seem to be a resistance problem. It might be a pharmacokinetics problem. Oral metronidazole is actually almost 100% absorbed in the small intestines, not exactly what you want to treat an infection that occurs in the colon. In patients with colonic inflammation, though, metronidazole is secreted back into the colon in quantities sufficient to kill C. difficile. However, as the colonic inflammation decreases, the level of metronidazole in the colon decreases. Perhaps with this new, perhaps hypervirulent strain, we need higher levels of metronidazole in the colon for a longer period of time to achieve a cure. That's really purely speculative on my part. What we do need is contemporary comparative data with metronidazole versus PO vancomycin. So what do we use initially? Do we use metronidazole? Do we use PO vancomycin? There are actually two editorials published within the last 18 months that address this. Both were in Clinical Infectious Diseases, and both came to pretty much the same conclusion, that the majority of patients should still receive metronidazole initially. In patients with leukocytosis, in patients who were worsened during the first 48 hours of therapy, or in patients with renal insufficiency, oral vancomycin should be considered. So my summary points are that the incidence of CDAD is increasing, especially in the elderly. There also seems to be increasing morbidity and mortality associated with the disease. A previously rare strain of C. diff is circulating and is likely to be at least partially responsible for the above. Metronidazole may no longer be appropriate as first-line agent in all cases. And judicious use of antimicrobials and adherence to infection control measures is crucial to controlling CDAD. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much, John. We really appreciate that. That was a great overview of the changing nature of C. diff and the Quebec outbreak, and some good information on historical and recent studies. We're going to take it a little closer to home right now, and instead of taking questions at this moment, we're going to go through the two other speakers' presentations. So, Brian Cole, whenever you're ready to talk about the experience with C. diff at Beth Israel. Dr. Cole? Brian? Well, maybe instead of Brian, we'll find out where Brian Cole is, but Donna Armolino and Dr. Farber, if you could go through the North Shore University Hospital experience and then describe a bit about the bundle that you've developed there, that would be great.
Sure. Just give me 1 second. I'm pulling it up.
Sure.
Much of what has been said is there's a lot of repetition, obviously, and so I'm going to try to, avoid that. And I'd like to briefly go through these slides, avoiding some of the repetition, and then bring up the bundle and then bring up several of the problems that we've encountered, not only with the bundle, but just in general with C. difficile control. As already pointed out, on your handout, I think everyone already knows that Clostridium difficile is basically a disease that is a tale of two cities, the old C. difficile and the new C. difficile. And the old C. difficile, as we just heard, was a different organism genetically. The toxin production was less. The mortality was lower. The relapse rate was there, but probably lower. And basically, it's been around for a long time. And although a hospital like ours had intermittently seen fairly frequent colonizations as well as outbreaks, they were relatively easy to control by just gearing up for them with better infection control and better environmental control. Our hospital at that time was seeing roughly 10 to 15 cases per month. I included one case presentation because I think it's another aspect of this problem that hasn't been given enough attention, and I'll just briefly review it. And that was a 58-year-old male who was in good health, and four days prior to his admission, he received ciprofloxacin after an IND of a skin abscess. He subsequently developed diarrhea, which was treated with over-the-counter Imodium, and then presented to the hospital here on with confusion, fever, abdominal pain, shortness of breath, a white count of 30,000, hypotension, and a CAT scan that was evident with colitis. He was taken to the operating room and had a total colectomy within 4 hours of admission, and the stools were positive for C. diff. Now, why this case is illustrative of one other aspect of this problem is the fact that the new C. diff that we're talking about now, these strains, that were talked about in the last presentation so well, also are community acquired. And we're seeing a significant number of community acquired cases of C. diff in people who have not been in the hospital, have not been in nursing homes, and actually have received either no antibiotic therapy, which is less common than the more common case, which is a brief course of quinolones or beta-lactam antibiotics. So I think that this organism is out there, and it's more than just out there in the hospital environment. And as a result of this, this will certainly complicate, as does community-acquired MRSA, control measures in the future and limiting the epidemic. I'm going to really not go through the next slide because it was just covered so well in the last presentation. And I think the same thing occurs with the slide thereafter, other than to say that in addition to the elderly, this is an organism that we see has a much higher morbidity as well as mortality. If you go to my next slide, which is Clostridia difficile at North Shore Hospital, you can see that we plotted out the average number of cases that we were seeing on a graph during the years 2003, 2004, 2005, and 2006. And I think it was clear to us intuitively, and I think it's clear that the rates have clearly gone up. And they bounce around from month to month, and you certainly cannot use a month-to-month number to foresee trends or declare victory, because there is some variation. But overall, there was a clear increase in the number of cases, in addition to which, as I previously mentioned, we started seeing roughly 8 to 10 cases per month that were not traditional nosocomial cases. And that, for us, was a dramatic change in the spectrum of C. diff that was happening. I know you already know about the new strain, the NAP1 strain, but just look at the numbers from Canada and from the United Kingdom. You see that in those places where C. diff was reportable, and as you all know, C. diff is not reportable in New York or in the United States, something that I'm not sure is a good thing, the rates of infection went from roughly 100 per 100,000 population up to an almost nine-fold increase in the calendar year 2003 to 866 per 100,000. And similar numbers, very similar numbers, were reported from Great Britain when they looked at their epidemiology. Basically, they went up to roughly 80 per 100,000, and 80% of their cases were in patients over the age of 65, similar to what has reported here. So if we now go to the meat of this presentation, which is to talk about what we can do to control C. diff. And I think everyone was very impressed that the bundling concept worked very well in the IHI initiative. And we thought that, you know, this is something that we might want to consider for C. diff as well as for MRSA. So we came up with this bundle, and it's certainly a work in progress. It is not by any means complete, and we have by no means been able to totally enforce this in our own facility. But nevertheless, it's worthwhile in terms of a number of thoughts. So let me go through first prevention. One is, I think, key is the rapid information from the laboratory to the patient care unit physician and the infection control personnel. What I mean by that is that in the best-case scenario, which we do not have but hopefully someday will, that as soon as the technician finds out that in the laboratory a patient has C. difficile in a stool assay, that as it's entered into the computer, that the patient also is automatically put on isolation, and the physician is also notified automatically by some means. And so then there would be absolutely no delay in getting that patient on isolation. It would prevent the three-day delay on long weekends. It would prevent the delay in the evenings. It would prevent the lack of communication that frequently occurs. We have here, made this into a critical value, so a positive C. diff is at least called to the floor so that the floor knows immediately. Secondly, the implementation of contact precautions is still the best we can do at the moment, although by no means a perfect solution. A contact sign is placed on the door. The patient is placed in a private room or cohorted with somebody else with C. diff. Appropriate PPEs, gowns, and gloves are utilized by staff. Dedicated patient care equipment is utilized. If not possible, it is decontaminated after use on the patient. And the patient is maintained on these precautions for 3 months after symptoms have resolved, regardless of whether it's a new admission or whether the diarrhea has completely resolved. Some issues right away here that have come up are the fact that, you know, there's concern about the utility of alcohol, gels. You know, we personally are not convinced that they do not work, but obviously there's concern out there how well they work. So that complicates things in terms of educating patients as well as the staff, more importantly, that when they leave the room, that they need to wash their hands as well as using the alcohol gels. Secondly, with regards to dedicated equipment, that's always problematic. The dedicated stethoscopes that we put in these rooms are crummy, and as a result, people don't like to use them. They get lost. They get placed in different parts of the room. They're not easy to locate, and so they're frequently not used. That therefore means that something like a stethoscope has to be alcohol swabbed down or covered with a stethoscope condom, and under those circumstances, compliance is more difficult to achieve than even compliance with hand washing and gown and gloving. Similar problems apply to the stethoscope to the blood pressure cuff that is also placed in the room. The other issues that we've come up with before I go right to the bundle have to do with the diagnosis of C. diff. And that's that the diagnosis of C. diff is also fraught with controversy and hazard. Although we would all consider an ELISA that's looking for toxin A and B, which most commercially ELISAs do, as presumptive proof of C. diff, or the presence of pseudomembranes on a sigmoidoscopy or colonoscopy with the right clinical scenario, there's problems with both of those. First, with the ELISA assay, we know that one negative can miss as many as 20, 25, 15% of cases. So we need multiple isolates. And even when three are obtained, there's no absolute guarantee that you're going to not miss 5% of cases of C. diff. Now, we do not culture, nor do most institutions do, cultures for C. diff. Cultures for C. diff might help with regards to isolation, similar to surveillance cultures for MRSA, but are not easy to do, are not readily obtainable, and are not helpful in diagnosing acute cases of C. difficile colitis. In addition to which, although we suspect, we don't really have the data to prove that the reservoir of people out there who are excreting C. diff from nursing homes and from hospitalized patients, and now even from the community who are admitted to the hospital, that we know whether those patients who may or may not be significant reservoirs for the propagation of epidemics of C. diff. Clearly, there's precedent for that to occur, i.e. the MRSA epidemic, where I think most people realize that surveillance is the key to limiting control, and that if we don't do surveillance for patients for MRSA, that we're only isolating the tip of the iceberg, and many of the patients out there that we're not isolating are carrying it and spreading it, and once you're carrying it, you're at dramatically increased risk for getting infected. That may apply with C. difficile. The data's not in, but even if it does apply, we don't have a rapid screening tool that's readily available to us to look for the undoubtedly larger number of patients who are carrying C. difficile that we have not identified through clinical disease. The next point with regards to diagnosis is in that group of patients that have negative C. diff titers but also have diarrhea, what do we do about them? Do they get isolated or do they not get isolated, number one? Number two is, do we have laboratory facilities to reflexively do a cytotissue culture assay to see whether there is at least a cytotissue toxin assay in those patients suggestive of C. difficile or, in rare instances, another infectious diarrhea like MRSA-producing toxin or Klebsiella oxytosa, as was recently described. And most of our facilities do not have that ability. We have that ability here, but we do not use it very often, and there's not a real good mechanism by which we know which patients are at high enough risk to have C. difficile, should be tested even if their ELISA assays are negative, and which group of people have diarrhea caused by osmotic loads, tube feedings, antibiotics, and other agents in the hospital that cause diarrhea that are not related to C. diff. That all being said, I want to go through the sample bundle, if you will, that we came up with, and then make a couple of other comments regarding treatment. So if you follow along with me, and I hope you all have this, excuse me, the bundle that you see here is, I'll go through. And basically, it says yes, no, the medication usage. Was the patient on antibiotics prior to the onset of symptoms, and if so, list? And we certainly agree that quinolones lead the list, and clindamycin is not as common a problem as it was before. And although I'm not sure that there's any difference in quinolones because of some soft data,
we have removed moxifloxacin from our formulary and put Levaquin on with the hope that that quinolone may be a little bit worse. Secondly, the patient is on a protein pump inhibitor. Now, I know this, too, is often controversial. A recent article just came out in CID that demonstrated that protein pump inhibitors are not an important risk factor for the development of C. difficile. On the other hand, there have been a bunch of other articles that have demonstrated that it is. And theoretically, it makes some sense. Certainly, there are a host of infectious diseases that you decrease the inoculum that you need to get them by putting somebody on a protein pump inhibitor. We put this on the list because we think that there's way too much promiscuous use of protein pump inhibitors among our patients. It literally gets used all the time for a variety of conditions that often do not have proper indication. And although the IHI guidelines for VAP indicated that gastric acidity should be controlled to decrease the risk of GI bleeding, that applied only to patients on ventilators for more than 72 hours, and they did not even specify that it had to be a protein pump inhibitor. Thirdly, upon identification of a case, treatment with orally administered metronidazole or in severe cases vancomycin was started. And then next, a positive result was called to the patient care unit within 4 hours of the positive result. Contact signs or a new sign were placed on the right side of the door within 24 hours of the positive result. Contact precautions is entered on Envision, which is our computer screen, which would alert everyone else who deals with the patient, regardless of whether they're transferred to another floor or for a procedure within 24 hours. The patient is placed in a private room or cohorted within 24 hours of the positive result. The healthcare workers don gloves and a gown prior to performing direct peer patient contact. If the gloves and gowns were worn, they were removed prior to exiting the room, and hands were washed with soap and water. And then, of course, we go to environmental cleaning and disinfection. The bathroom is cleaned with a chlorine-based hypochlorite disinfectant after each occupied day and upon discharge. And the patient care equipment is dedicated to the patient. A stethoscope, a blood pressure cuff, and a thermometer are part of a kit that Donna's put together that goes in the room in people on contact precautions. We're working on it, I should say. Where a dedicated kit is coming. And that is the initial bundle, if you will, that we came up with. I'm going to turn the presentation over to Donna in 1 minute, who's going to go through a couple of additional slides with regards to some data that she's collected on how we're doing. But I want to just make one other comment regarding the therapy. And a lot of clinicians are extremely frustrated by the lack of appropriate therapy for C. diff, by the high failure rate with metronidazole, and by the high relapse rate. And there's obviously no right answer, but I just want to say that when somebody doesn't have good therapy, when we don't have good therapy for a disease, people often use therapy that they think might work, even though the data is not terribly impressive. And so I just want to mention that, one, and anecdotally, because there's not a lot of good data, we are not impressed with the use of Bacid. We are not impressed with the use of Fluoristor, which are now being used extensively by people in our hospital. And with regards to gamma globulin therapy, we are reserving that for critically ill patients who are in danger of undergoing colectomy when we're trying to avoid that possibility. Donna?
The last two slides just represent infections, or at least the hospital-associated infections that we define as being those that present 48 hours after admission. We're not using the CDC definition as community-acquired versus hospital-acquired. We're only looking at those cases that we feel are associated with this particular hospital, because those are the ones we may be able to impact on. So they are monitored monthly. We do calculate a rate per 1,000 patient care days. We also calculate rates of infection per ICU as well as individual units, just so we could see where there's some clustering. The next slide, or at least the second to last slide, you'll see we identified infections per year, 2006 being infections up until April of 2006. We started with education, and we are starting to implement portions of the bundle. So you'll see I have a separate rate from May to October. The positive is we're not going up. We cannot call it a success at this point, but at least the numbers are not increasing. So that is one of the positives. The bundle itself, we have implemented components of it, not in its entirety. We do plan on monitoring compliance with this bundle and only addressing the first, for example, the first 10 cases per month, just to identify where we need to focus some of our attention. The hospital itself identifies 35 to 40 cases per month. As far as collecting bundle data on each one of these cases, it's very time consuming, so that's why we elected to just do the first 10 per month and then try to address the issues. Is it staff education? Is it the contact precaution issue? Is it the reporting from the laboratory? And that was the intent of looking at some of the bundles and monitoring the compliance piece. As mentioned earlier, yes, we are going to be putting a kit together, a contact precaution kit, but it's not as easy as I initially thought. We have various blood pressure cuffs throughout the building, so we need to identify a universal valve and then make sure we're able to get accurate blood pressures. And then electronic thermometer. There had to be some quality control that was done on the electronic thermometers. And then also to have dedicated or at least a group of oral thermometers and rectal thermometers. A number of years ago, like most places, they have the IVAC thermometer where the oral and the rectal are in one unit. We removed the orals from some and the rectal from others, but if you go around the hospital now, you'll see them side by side. So those will be removed from the building shortly. So hopefully by the end of the year, we'll be able to monitor the complete bundle and be able to identify bundle compliance, and that hopefully will go up as the C. diff cases decrease.
Thank you, both Dr. Farber and Donna. That was a great presentation and an excellent overview of the bundle, the C. diff bundle there. I know there are most likely lots of questions out there because there are some people that have called us about that. But before we go into the questions, I know Brian Cole is on the line. We had some technical glitches there. So, Brian Cole.
Hello.
Great. We can hear you now. So if you could go through your presentation, that would be great, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Sure. Some of this will have some similar information that was presented in the prior to PowerPoint presentation, so I also will try not to be redundant and, in the interest of time, move somewhat quickly. The first thing that I'm sure everybody's aware of is that C. difficile is a common cause of antibiotic-associated diarrhea. It's associated with a colitis sepsis syndrome, which places patients at risk for colectomy and major morbidity and mortality. And the cost annually to the United States healthcare system for C. difficile is more than $1 billion. In terms of sort of take-home messages and sort of our bundle, the first thing regarding our bundle really began with education. And the education is number one. C. difficile is often a hospital-acquired infection, which can be spread from person to person. It can cause antibiotic-associated diarrhea and colitis. That it may present as a life-threatening sepsis syndrome with impressive leukocytosis and a paradoxically unimpressive abdomen with diarrhea, and that the first part of our bundle is the key to diagnosis is a high index of suspicion. And really, for anybody who either develops diarrhea who is admitted with diarrhea, the first thing that we want everybody to think of is C. difficile. And the reason for that is if they think C. difficile, they will begin to implement a set of measures which will be protective for our other patients and staff for C. difficile, but for other enteric pathogens. The next part of our bundle is contact precautions and hand hygiene. We actually have hand hygiene compliance here close to 100%, and that really is due to nursing enforcement. And the one thing that we will do for C. difficile, we actually have a separate C. difficile contact precaution sign, whereas regular contact precautions, we encourage people to use the alcohol-based hand products. For C. difficile, we do say use soap and water. The one part of the bundle which we really don't have a good handle on is appropriate antibiotic usage. We have developed, there has been a tool developed to monitor fluoroquinolone use. Not quite yet in place, but because of the association with a new highly virulent C. diff with quinolones, we are really trying to restrict the use of quinolones. One thing that I'm not necessarily a big believer in, but people do use it, is the addition of yogurt or equivalent to the diet for patients receiving antibiotics. But the next part of our bundle after precautions and washing with soap and water, begin treatment. And you really can begin treatment before you send stool samples, not interfere with diagnosis. And the other thing is that agents that slow the colon should not be used in C. diff cases. We would expect the primary caregiver to either call GI, infectious diseases, or surgery when appropriate. That upon discharge, patients who had C. diff get a special set of instructions so that if they do develop diarrhea at home and there's a concern about a relapse, that they're supposed to call for help sooner rather than later. And then the last thing that we do here is has to do really with patient placement and environmental protocols. So the first thing is we really want to place patients in a private room with their own bathroom when possible, if not, cohort. But the bottom line is our hospital is usually at 110% capacity, and we're really pressed for beds in terms of what we're able to do. And we really then have to use our best judgment, and what we will try to do at least is try not to put a patient with diarrhea in the same room as a patient who is either pre-op or a fresh post-op. But if that is the last bed in the hospital, then that bed will be used. Gloves and gowns are to be worn when entering the room, and that's regardless even if you're going to examine a patient. We really want people to get into the habit that the minute they cross the threshold, the spores can be in the environment, and they have to really dress, I would say, appropriately. In terms of dedicated equipment, thermometers, blood pressure cuffs, we're getting better at. They are cleaned in between patients. We do not have dedicated stethoscopes here. The sort of, I'll say, disposable stethoscopes or the stethoscopes that we've looked at are really not useful to listen to anything. So what everyone has gotten into the habit of doing is cleaning their stethoscopes with alcohol or using the stethoscope condoms. In terms of cleaning, basically the rooms are cleaned daily with a 1 to 100 dilution of Clorox. And when the patient is discharged, it's a 1 to 10 dilution of Clorox. We have run into some difficulty where people are allergic to bleach. And we haven't had it with patients, but we have had it with staff. And in one case, there was actually an anaphylactic reaction to the bleach. Regarding lab testing, I know that was discussed. The only thing that I would add is that no more than one specimen should be submitted on a given day, and that if the initial test is negative, we would send a second or third sample. The limitations of detecting C. diff have already been discussed. We're fortunate here that one of our supervisors actually is an expert in culturing C. difficile. So on occasion, we may go that route although it's not an easy thing to do. And again, to emphasize that the need to submit stool samples for testing should not delay the start of antimicrobial therapy, as therapy does not eliminate the toxin from the stool. Pretty much everyone here has spoken a little bit about the what happened in Quebec. The only thing that I would like to add, which has been touched upon, is that prior antibiotic use used to be considered a prerequisite for the development of C. difficile, but no more. In 2005, there were 33 cases reported to the CDC in patients without traditional risk factors. 10 were peripartum women, 23 community-acquired cases, 5 children. About a third had not had any type of antibiotics in the preceding 3 months. And out of this group that developed C. diff, about a quarter required hospitalization, and over a third had evidence of relapse. We spoke a little bit about the fluoroquinolones and that there's varied and conflicting reports regarding the risk of C. difficile with one quinolone versus another. And it is suggested that fluoroquinolones with greater anaerobic activity confer an increased risk. Not all studies have found a relationship between the use of acid suppressing agents and C. difficile. The management pretty much is fluids and electrolyte replacement. Stop antimicrobials when possible. A lot of times that really is not an option for many of our patients. Regarding metronidazole therapy, again, the conflict with vancomycin has already been discussed. It's not really been proven to be superior to vancomycin, that there is an increase in metronidazole failures and relapses. It is less expensive. But of interest, initially everyone used metronidazole to stop the spread of vancomycin-resistant organisms, particularly VRE, and over time, what has been shown is that metronidazole has not been shown to slow the spread of vancomycin-resistant organisms. But what is done here, and I guess this isn't an official component yet of the bundle, but eventually it will make its way into it, is that vancomycin therapy is started sooner rather than later for those that are sicker. And what does that mean? Basically, white count greater than 20,000, clinical deterioration over the first 24 to 48 hours of metronidazole therapy, and somebody who has renal insufficiency. IV metronidazole will be used in someone who's got severe colitis. And then the other agents which are at our disposal, but of which there's really are not great evidence, are probiotics, anion-binding resins. We have used vancomycin tapers for patients with multiple relapses, which have seemed to be effective. And I think the last part of this just really is showing a little bit about where we are. 2004 was pretty much the baseline. 2005, we instituted in a systematic way the majority of what I've discussed. And then 2006, it's continued. And you can see that our rate has decreased from 2004 from 25 per 1,000 discharges to about 15, and yes, I know the 25 per 1,000 is a high rate. This is looking at C. diff cases pretty much across the board, where the average per month was about 22, and it's now down to about 15 per month. And this is looking just in actually our surgical patients, where in patients who were having gastric or bowel surgery, that's really where we've had a lot of our problems, and we've been able to pretty much eradicate it from our surgical service. Overall, we've had a 40% decrease in hospital-acquired C. diff, with more dramatic decrease in surgical services. I'm a big believer in the environmental protocols, and what's nice is it's an easy thing to monitor because you smell it. So you don't have to depend on someone watching. Our challenges here are the private room issues and the use of dedicated equipment. And I believe that's the end.
Thank you so much, Brian. glad we could hear you this time. We're actually going to ask the operator. We know there's probably a lot of people out there. This is a lot of good information, and there might be some questions or some comments from the group. So we're going to take the next 10, 15 minutes or so to get those. So, operator? Operator?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. One moment for questions. Our first question comes from Alexis Ramdy. Your line is open.
Hello? Hello?
Pardon me, Alexis. Your line is open.
I didn't ask any question.
Our next question comes from Diane Barnowinski. Your line is open.
Thank you. I enjoyed all three presentations. One question, or two questions, really. Do you see the relapse due to reinfection or truly a relapse? And then regarding the bundles, would you initiate posting of the contact isolation sign at point of high suspect, or do you wait until confirmation?
So anyone on the panel, if you want to answer Diane's questions?
For us at Beth Israel, the precautions are instituted upon suspicion.
Thank you.
It's pretty much the same thing here, although there's some subjectivity to, you know, what suspicion is and how suspicious. Certainly if the suspicion is high, yes. On the other hand, not everyone who gets a C. difficile assay sent to the lab automatically goes on precaution because the majority of our results are negative, and because hospital-acquired diarrhea is so common, and because people are so used to ordering the test, and because we have so few private rooms, that is not always the case in direct answer to your question.
Yeah.
Within the North Shore LIJ Health System, there is one hospital that will place the patient on contact precautions when symptoms present, and they do have the lowest rate of hospital-associated C. diff infection. They do have a little bit more real estate than the rest of us. They may have the ability to move people around.
Thank you. Thank you.
Our next. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key on your touch tone telephone. I'm not showing any further questions at this time.
Yeah. Are we still on?
Yes, we're still here.
I was wondering if Dr. Cole from Beth Israel could share with us by email at some point the protocol for limiting quinolone use and for monitoring quinolone use, because that would obviously be very helpful in trying to control this, and it's certainly one thing that we have not been very successful in getting a handle on.
That's not a problem. I'll be more than happy to share that.
Great. Actually, Dr. Cole, if you want to email that to us, we can send that around to the group if you're okay with that, and post it to the Jenny website also if you're okay with that.
Works for me.
Okay. I actually had a question about the kit for North Shore University Hospital. Was it sort of, did you go through the same process that you did with the CLABS kit to get buy-in from practitioners across the system, or are you starting at North Shore University Hospital first, or is it going to be more of like a system effort to get that kit out there?
It'll be more of a system effort. We just felt it might be easy to grab, you know, something that is put together rather than pull pieces.
An interesting concept, because I know we did that we encouraged it for CLABS, and it's an interesting concept to hear that it's getting going around to other infections and other areas, and I think that's great.
I can give you some feedback. Like I said, there was a couple of things that we needed to work out. You know, the quality assurance on the electronic thermometers, which would be single patient use, and then the issue of the universal valves because of the variations in the blood pressure cuffs.
That's great. Thank you.
This is Rachel. I have actually sort of a different type of question, and it might be a little bit off the wall or premature, but, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about kind of systems reengineering as one way to improve reliability and safety and so forth. And it does seem that one of the issues that is posed by C. diff, as you all have described this now in great detail, which was very interesting, and then as Hillary is going to indicate, our next call is going to be on MRSA, and I'm sure there are going to be others of these down the road, unfortunately. It does sound as though there is a need or an opportunity maybe to do some piloting around this issue of isolation bed capacity, and I'm just using that as kind of a, you guys probably have a more precise terminology to describe this, but it seems as though the ability to place patients somewhere that's safe for them and safe for everybody else is a key element of what you've described, and I guess obviously you're, you know, doing the best you can within your existing resources, but I guess I'm just curious if either in St. Peter's at North Shore or at Beth Israel, has this stimulated any thinking for you in terms of whether it would be feasible to look at sort of a process redesign here that would make it easier to find safe places, if you will, for these types of patients?
Well, I can comment, which is,
and does that make any sense? I mean, is that something that we should be working with hospitals on down the road?
Well, you know, starting in the year 2007, all new construction of hospitals in the United States will be only private rooms. And that's, you know, to make sure you get Medicare funding. And we have a commitment from our CEO, and in the new construction that's being done at North Shore, it's all private rooms. We have one floor in this hospital that will be completed in the winter of 2007 that will be private rooms. But, you know, retrofitting the rest of the hospital is not going to happen in probably my lifetime, and I doubt in most people's lifetime, because with the costs, you know, involved, even though it's great that new construction is going to be this way, it's going to take 20 to 30 years for that new construction to really catch up. And in the interim, as was pointed out at Beth Israel, when it gets crowded, you know, it's basically impossible. I mean, there's just no room to wiggle. You know, there's no way when the hospital is full that you have the luxury of handling it without leaving people in the halls and in situations that are even more dangerous. The private room concept is great, not only for C. diff, but for medication errors, for patient safety errors, for MRSA, for privacy, for everything else. And I think everyone has come to realize that, but it's a little bit, you know, late to do anything now that's going to have a dramatic impact for years.
And also, just to add to that, there's a very big, you know, very large pressure in that you want to get patients out of the emergency room as quickly as possible. But it's sort of a double-edged sword. You have gridlock up on the floors, and then you're getting just a massive push from the ED so that you can get backlogged.
And Hillary, to answer your question, yes, it is difficult to move patients around to get them isolated. Some facilities have ward-type settings with limited private rooms, and other facilities, all their ICUs are private rooms, and then they have an additional 50-plus rooms throughout the hospital. But that's only a select few hospitals that have that luxury.
I have one last question to both Beth Israel and North Shore University Hospital. Are you all starting this similar to the CLABS bundle in the ICU setting and then potentially expanding it beyond that, or are you really focusing on more of a hospital-wide effort for when you're talking about your bundles and your prevention strategies?
We were doing it here throughout the hospital. Actually, most of our C. diffs are outside the ICU, not right. within our intensive care units.
Mm-hmm.
So it was going to be a hospital-wide approach, not focusing on one particular area.
Same for us.
Thank you. And, operator, I'm just going to open it up one more time. Maybe there are some last thoughts or questions for any of our three groups.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. I have a follow-up question from Diane Bronswitzky. Your line is open.
Hi, Diane.
My question was, thank you. I had asked it before. Do you suspect any of the physicians, do you question that any of your readmissions are from a relapse or a reinfection or a new infection?
I'm sorry, we didn't answer that before. We believe they're relapses and not new infections. It's obviously impossible to prove in all circumstances, but this is a spore-forming organism. It's difficult to eliminate from the environment as well as from the colon, and I think that they're, relapses, not reinfections.
Thank you.
Brian, do you have anything to add to that?
I would say similarly. I think for us, just based on our definitions, we sort of have gone on, I guess, from like a 60 to 90-day cutoff, so that if somebody was in the hospital, was out, and then comes back, you know, in 90 days, does not present with diarrhea, and then develops diarrhea, to us, we wouldn't say that's a relapse. To us, we would actually say that's a new infection. But the bottom line is, because it's a spore, it's going to last forever.
Thank you. Operator, is there anyone else in the queue?
I'm not showing any further questions at this time.
Okay. Well, we want to really thank our three speakers for joining us and really supplying this introductory session on C. diff. And we may be focusing future calls on this topic. One thing we should mention, I'm actually going to the IHI forum, which is next week. So if they give any kind of announcing or unveiling about this topic and what they're going to present the C. diff bundle as, we'll definitely provide that information during that call. I'm not sure if they're going to be doing anything like that, but if they do, we'll definitely supply you with that information. So thanks again to the speakers. We're just going to go through a couple of last-minute kind of housekeeping type of things, and then Terry and Rachel, interrupt me if I forget anything. First of all, there was a little typo on the agenda. We said the next call is going to be on January 3rd, 2006. We apologize. It's January 3rd, 2007. Someone pointed that out to me today, and it will be 2007, the new year, at 2 p.m. And
no infections in 2007.
Exactly. That's our resolution. So, and the topic for that call, again, switching gears from CLABS, we're going to be focusing on MRSA, both community-wide and hospital-acquired. We do definitely have Dr. Barry Kreisworth from the Public Health Research Institute. He'll be coming on that call. We have also tried to contact someone from Maine Medical Center who we're hoping will attend because they've created some really good protocols and have a lot of information on this topic, but we'll keep you posted over the next couple of weeks once we have that formulated. And finally, I just want to say something about the CLAB infection data. I know Terry, Rachel, and I were overcome with excitement when we saw the latest results The September data, just note that we're still missing two hospitals' data, so it's not completely complete yet, but we're at around 1.9 infections per 1,000 central line days. And of special note, Brian Taylor, who works at Greater New York Hospital Association, always says to me, don't get too excited over the data. It doesn't really mean anything unless it's for 3 months in a row. But we have, for 3 months, July, August, and September, had among the hospitals that submit data, have had a rate under two infections per 1,000 central line days. And we think that's exciting and great, and everyone should be applauded for that. We're really happy about that.
And also worth noting, by the way, that that is, you know, we always sort of looked at July and August in particular as that very vulnerable time when the new residents were coming in and so forth and so on. So I think that since Brian told us we could actually celebrate this trend, I think it is worth noting that it's during a time of the year that we were particularly worried about before, and hopefully we've broken the back on the issue of resident training and competencies as part of this, and that we can keep that up.
Exactly. Terry, do you have anything to add?
No, just congratulations to everyone. We're thrilled, and we hope to keep it up, and we hope the hospitals who have not yet gotten to zero over the next couple of months are able to achieve that zero.
So, and that's pretty much all we wanted to talk about today. We have another bullet point here, an update on the hospitals joining the CLABS Collaborative in August 2006. So as you know, 9 additional hospitals joined the collaborative. Their conference calls have still been separate. We are going to integrate them together in February. So they've been a little slow going, but it's going well. And a few of you, thanks to a few of you on the call, you've actually come on their calls and provided some great overviews of your work, and it's definitely helped them along the way. So with that, operator, I'm going to ask you one last time if there's any questions about anything. Operator?
Yes, I'm here.
Can you just open it up for questions, and then we'll call it a day?
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone.
All right, I guess we'll call it a day, Hillary.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, everyone.
Yeah,
happy holidays.
Everybody.
Holidays, and Hillary. Thank you to the speakers. That was great.
No infections in 2007.
Bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation and have a wonderful day.